The Peter Schiff Show.
I'd like to thank Raycon for supporting the Peter Schiff Show podcast. Get crisp, powerful beats at half the price of other premium audio brands. Raycon's offering you 15% off their products, and here's what you got to do to get it. Just go to buyraycon.com/gold. Earlier this morning, we got the release of the CPI data for the month of April. Now, normally, there's very little anticipation with respect to this release because, after all, every month it's either 0.1, 0.2. It's really no big deal. Nobody really cares because the series barely moves. Inflation is below 2%, at least the way the government officially measures it with the CPI. Although there was a lot more anticipation with respect to this release than I have seen in the past. There are a lot of people kind of nervous about the number, despite the fact that the consensus forecast was for an increase of just 0.2. Now, it made no sense that the forecast was so low. Now, there was a range of forecasts, the low end being 0.1 and the upper end being 0.5. But obviously, most of the estimates came in quite a bit below 0.5, which is why the mean consensus number was just 0.2. But it didn't make sense to me that Wall Street would be so sanguine on consumer prices, not only given what's obviously happening, but looking at what's happened to the CPI in the first 3 months of the year. In the month of January, we were up by 0.3. In the month of February, we were up by 0.4. In the month of March, we were up by 0.6. Clearly a trend developing. Why would anybody expect the next number in that sequential series of months to collapse down to 0.2, which would have been quite a bit lower than the lowest reading of the year that happened all the way back in January? To me, and I said this when I talked about the March number a month ago on my podcast, that I thought the April number was likely to be higher than the March number. And in fact, I was correct. We got the number and it ended up being 0.8, which blew away estimates way above even the highest in the consensus range of 0.5, 0.8. That's 1 month. This is the biggest monthly gain in the CPI since 1981. And to put 1981 in perspective, that's the year I graduated from high school. I'm 58 years old right now. And the last time there was a month over month increase in the CPI this large, it was 1981. And of course, the CPI was more honest back then because it hadn't been, you know, reconfigured based on the Boskin Commission to understate inflation. So if we were still measuring inflation using the same methodology that was in place when I was in high school, the number would be much higher than 0.8. Now, the key is, though, looking at what's already happened so far this year, if you take the first 4 months of the year, consumer prices are already up by 2%. That is the Fed's goal, right? Their target of 2% a year inflation. And we've already hit the entire target in the first one third of the year. Now, if you assume that the rest of the year is identical to the first 4 months, we just repeat the same numbers for the next 2 4-month periods, inflation for the entire year will come in at 6%, which is well above anything that the Fed should be able to consider acceptable when they're claiming with a straight face that their target is for inflation to average 2%. Obviously, nobody believes that we're going to get a repeat of the last 4 months over the next 2 4-month periods. But if you look at the numbers, why would you assume that the trend that's already in motion isn't going to stay in motion? If the current trend stays and every month we get a 0.2% increase, right? We were 0.4 in February, 0.6 in March, 0.8 in April. Maybe May price will rise by a full percent. If we continue this acceleration from now through the end of the year, 2021, the CPI will increase by better than 20% for the year. Now, I don't think that this curve is going to continue to accelerate at the same pace. So I would bet that the CPI is not going to be 20% for 2021, although it is possible. But I do think that we're going to end up north of 10%. So I think we're going to continue to pick up speed when it comes to inflation, albeit it may be at a somewhat slower rate than what we've experienced in the acceleration over the past few months. But I expect many more months throughout the year where we will have monthly increases that are higher than the 0.8% increase that just broke that record all the way back to 1981. Now, of course, a lot of people would expect that when you get inflation numbers that are not only this bad, but this much worse than what had been expected, that you would see a rise in the price of gold and silver. After all, they are the key inflation hedges. And if there's a lot more inflation than investors think, well, you think that they should be buying more gold and silver to hedge the inflation. But again, that is not the way it happened. As soon as these numbers came out, the price of gold got clobbered down about 10 bucks. And as I am recording this podcast, and it's about 12:45 on the East Coast, gold's down about $17 and silver's down about 46 cents. So why are gold and silver getting clobbered in the face of higher than expected inflation? In fact, it's not just gold and silver, it's the US dollar. The dollar strengthened immediately after these numbers were released. And in fact, the dollar index now is up 0.6 at 90.75. It was getting ready to drop below 90 before these numbers came out. And paradoxically, it was much worse than expected inflation numbers that caused an increase in the dollar's value. Again, inflation by definition is a measurement of the dollar losing purchasing power. So why is news that the dollar is losing purchasing power even faster than we thought? Why is that bullish for the dollar? Why do people want to buy dollars more as they're losing value even faster? You would think that the news that inflation is a lot worse than people thought, meaning the dollar is losing value faster than we thought it would, that it would spark people who are holding on to dollars to want to get rid of them. But again, that is not the way markets are working. And it's not manipulation. A lot of people immediately they see, oh, this proves that gold prices are being manipulated. After all, why is gold going down on news that should make it go up? It must be manipulation. It's not manipulation. It's stupidity. It's the stupidity of the traders because they continue to operate under the false premise that these hotter than expected inflation numbers are going to cause the Fed to raise rates sooner rather than later. So that is what is hurting gold. It is the expectation that we're going to have rate hikes sooner, not later. That is what is helping the dollar, expectation of higher interest rates. Plus, also, if the Fed is going to be forced to fight inflation, well, they're going to have to start shrinking their balance sheet. So they're going to have to start tapering and, in fact, maybe even outright liquidating assets from their portfolio. So it is the prospects of tighter monetary policy to fight off an incipient inflation problem that is suppressing gold and supporting the dollar. Now, eventually, these traders are going to have to figure out what should already be obvious, and that's that the Fed is not going to fight inflation, because even if it tried, it couldn't do it, which is why it won't, which is why I've been saying there will be no fight. The Fed is going to surrender. Inflation is going to win by default, and inflation is going to be much worse than the markets expect. Even if we just repeat what we had in the first 4 months of the year for the next 2 4-month periods, and inflation as measured by the CPI is only 6% in 2021, there is no way the Fed is going to get ahead of that inflation curve once it's so far behind. Because if inflation is 6% in 2021, it's going to be much higher than 6% in 2022. The only way the Fed will prevent that from happening would be to get out in front of a 6% CPI, which means interest rates have to go to 8% or 10%. That is impossible, so it's not going to happen. In fact, the Fed is going to be creating more inflation as inflation numbers get worse, because as inflation pushes up the cost of living, that's going to restrain the economy. The economy is going to end up moving into recession because of the increase in inflation, and the Fed is going to ignore the inflation problem as it tries to tackle the problems in the economy and in rising unemployment, which is ultimately going to happen as a result of increases in inflation, because it is going to depress real consumer spending, because the prices of all the things that consumers want to buy are going to be going way up. And of course, a lot of the stuff that they want to buy, they're not even going to be able to buy it because it's not even going to be there, because we're going to have widespread shortages, not only because of production bottlenecks, but because consumers who can read the writing on the wall that the Fed is blind to, consumers are going to start stocking up on stuff. So the minute you see something on a shelf that you know you're going to need in the foreseeable future, you're not going to wait until you need it when it may not be available and it's going to cost a lot more money. You're going to buy it right now. So this inflation mindset is going to set in long before the Fed acknowledges that the problem isn't transitory. So from my perspective, though, any weakness in gold should be bought if the weakness is a result of higher than expected inflation, because inflation is good news for gold. The bad news for the economy is that the Fed can't do anything about it. In fact, the Fed is deliberately creating inflation because inflation is the only policy option that it thinks is politically viable. So when traders figure this out, gold is going to be bought on bad inflation numbers, not sold. But in the meantime, the selling will be muted because the real money understands what's going on and they're buying. It's just a lot of these futures traders that still don't get it. But the real physical market is tightening as higher inflation is going to push more people into gold and silver. We are going to have a pullback in the stock market, particularly in these high momentum stocks that are going to be hurt by higher inflation and rising rates. And speaking about interest rates, yields are backing up. And of course, that's what's also scaring the gold market. The yield on the U.S. 10-year Treasury up at 1.684. This is the highest we've been since, I think, early April. I think we're going to hit a new high for the year, maybe by next week, even sooner maybe on the 30-year, which is just below 2.4, 2.395. The highest it's been this year is 2.505. And I think we're going to take that high out pretty soon. But again, the increase in interest rates ultimately is going to cause the Federal Reserve to increase the size of its asset purchase program. It is going to be forced to buy more treasuries as yields are rising to prevent the yields from rising even faster. And as more people begin to accept and understand how bad the inflation problem is, a lot of people who have been holding on to U.S. treasuries are going to want to dump them. And given the fact that the official inflation rate is well above the nominal yield on treasuries, the only one dumb enough to buy it will be the Fed, because the Fed doesn't care, because it doesn't really cost the Fed any money, because it prints the money to buy the bonds. But the problem is, as it prints money to buy treasuries, it destroys the value of the money that they're printing, which means it also destroys the value of the treasuries, because all the treasuries are future promises to pay U.S. dollars, which are being debased to artificially suppress rates. Actually, checking out the tail of the tape on the April CPI, take a look at the year-over-year number. The prior number was up 2.6%, and the consensus was for an increase to 3.6%. That would have been bad enough, except the actual number we got was 4.2%. That is the biggest year-over-year increase in the CPI since 2008, although that record is likely to fall as soon as we get the May number. Looking at ex food and energy, the month-over-month increase, stripping out food and energy, was supposed to be 0.3, and that was going to match the 0.3 from the prior month. Instead, the actual number was three times as high, 0.9% increase in the so-called core rate, which actually exceeds the 0.8% of the headline rate. Then if you strip out food and energy and look at the year-over-year gain in the core, prior month was up 1.6. The expectation was April would be up 2.3 year-over-year. Actually, it came out at 3% even. core CPI year over year, 3%, already 50% higher than the Fed's supposed 2% target. We also got some other inflation numbers that came out today. We got the Atlanta Fed business inflation's expectation number, and that was at 2.5% last month. They revised that up to 2.6, and now the number's at 2.8. So even Atlanta Fed, their own survey shows that expectations for inflation now are at 2.8. Again, we're much closer to 3% than the official 2% target. And of course, in the months ahead, we're going to start to put a lot of distance between 3% and where the expectation is going to be, because prices are going to continue to rise. In fact, look what's happening. Oil prices today are back above $66 a barrel. So even as stock prices are getting killed, oil prices continue to go up. Oil stocks are some of the only stocks in the U.S. market that are trading higher today. Although looking on my screen, there is a lot of green when it comes to global stocks. We continue to not only see a rotation out of growth and into value, but out of U.S. names into foreign names, which is exactly the type of rotation that I have been anticipating for years and that I have positioned myself and my clients to benefit from. And while I'm talking about gas prices, I also want to talk about what's been going on with the shortage of gasoline in many U.S. states because of a cyber attack on Colonial Pipeline. There was like a ransomware blackmail thing. It shut down the pipeline. And of course, that backed up distribution of gasoline. And of course, one of the problems is a lot of these gas stations, it's not like they're sitting on a whole bunch of inventory, right? They expect to have their inventories constantly replenished. Nobody's really stockpiling a bunch of gasoline. And so if something happens to disrupt the new deliveries, well, they're all starting to run out. And that's what's going on. And you're looking at on the internet, you can see pictures of these long gas lines, you know, reminiscent of the 1970s. I read articles where people are waiting online for 4 to 5 hours to get gasoline. Now, this is going to be happening, I think, not just with gasoline. I think it's going to be happening with all sorts of products going forward as more and more supply just isn't there and we have constant demand based on printing press money. But, you know, it's interesting. The main reason that people are waiting so long is because, once again, the local governments are out there threatening to punish any gas stations for gouging. And even though prices have moved up somewhat, they're not going up enough, obviously, because people are waiting online for 5 hours. But if these local politicians didn't grandstand and allowed gas stations to charge any price that the market would bear, people wouldn't be waiting online, because prices would go up to the point that there wouldn't be a line. Yes, they'd be a lot more expensive, but that is the way the market would solve the problem of a gas shortage. Because if gas stations were allowed to charge a price that actually reflected true supply and demand, what would happen? Well, number one, people that don't really need the gas wouldn't go out and buy it, right? Right now, you probably have people, they're unemployed, they're sitting at home, they're going to get gas anyway, even though they don't need it because they're worried that it won't be there. They just want to get some gas. Well, if you let the price go up, a lot of these marginal buyers who don't really need gas will decide to wait. It's too expensive. I don't really need it right now. I'll wait, you know, until there's no longer a shortage. That means the people who really need the gas, for whatever reason, they'll end up paying more, but they're not going to have to wait in a 4 or 5 hour line. Also, if you let the price go way up, what that's going to do is bring in additional supply from neighboring states, because now all of a sudden, hey, we can get a lot of gas if we bring it into these other states because the price is so much higher. But if you don't let the price go way up, well, then you're not going to be able to recoup the costs to have people taking gas from one state and shipping it into another state. So what ends up happening is, because the politicians want to pretend that they care about the consumers, we don't have any alleviation of the shortage. The shortage continues. And also, if gas stations knew that, hey, if there ever was a shortage, they could charge whatever the market would bear, that might lead more gas stations to have bigger tanks where they can keep emergency gas just in case. So if there is a shortage, you know, they could make some good money selling the gas that they stocked up on at a much higher price. But if they can't do that, well, then it's not going to offset the cost of storing all the gas, so they don't do it. And so governments with these type of policies end up making all the problems worse. Now, I know a lot of people will say, well, Peter, if they just let the price go way up, well, only the rich people will get gas. Look, the rich people get gas right now. You know how they do it? They pay poor people to wait in line for them. That's what ends up happening. You say, hey, you know, here's my car. Go wait in a 4 or 5 hour line and get me gas. And so they still end up paying more, and they end up getting the gas because they can hire somebody to wait in line. And so now the person who makes the money is the guy that's filling up somebody else's tank instead of the gas station that should be making the money. You have somebody in between that ends up making the money. But it's all about politicians. It's form over substance. Oh, it's terrible. How dare this gas station charge higher prices for gas and take advantage of the situation? They're not taking advantage of the situation. I mean, the market is working. And yes, let's let the gas stations make more money when the price of gas goes up. I mean, what's terrible about that? In the meantime, the high gas price is going to bring in more supply. It's going to reduce demand, and prices will ultimately be lower, and you're not going to have these long lines. And what is the value of that? What is the cost of that? If you actually have to wait in line 4 or 5 hours to get your gas, what is your time worth? You know, if you just paid more for the gas, but you could just go right up to the pump, fill up, and leave, even if you're paying twice as much, it's actually a better bargain if you figure out what your time is worth.
Ever feel like no matter how hard you work, you just can't seem to get ahead? Well, there's a good explanation for that, but it's a maddening one. The government intentionally and dramatically underreports the true cost of living. And it's this fake low number that most employers use when setting the wages they pay. So your paycheck isn't growing nearly as fast as it needs to in order to keep up with inflation.
People who are middle income and lower income, people who go to work and get raises, their raises are based on the CPI. So you have people who are working their tails off, paying taxes, doing everything right, but they're getting increases that are keeping them from actually making any money. In fact, they're losing purchasing power every single year.
Hello and welcome to Peak Prosperity. This is Peak Prosperity co-founder Adam Taggart, welcoming you back for another week of making sense of money and the markets. And this week we welcome Ed Butowski to the program. Ed spent his career in wealth management, first working for big investment banks like Morgan Stanley and Bear Stearns, and eventually founding his own firm, Chapwood Investments LLC, where he publishes the much known and respected Chapwood Index, which tracks the true cost of living across America. And that's what we're going to be focusing on in today's discussion with him. Ed, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Adam.
All right, Ed. So we're going to get into the cost of living and the Chapwood Index and all that. But before we do, I just want to start with a general question for you, which is, what is your assessment of the current state of today's economy and financial markets?
Yeah, I'm happy you're asking that question. I was just doing some studying on the overall market valuation. And no matter what metric you look at, if you do any kind of regression analysis, the market is very expensive. And all you have to do is look at expected earnings growth and what the PE is. If you look backwards at the PE for 2020, you're looking at a price earnings multiple of 36. Right now, you're looking at a forward price earnings multiple of about 23. So you would have to have 23% earnings growth over last year to justify the valuation of the market. And you don't have the GDP growth that you need either. I mean, you know, we're looking at this next quarter GDP growth being, you know, somewhere around 5 or 6%. But, you know, that has to be every single quarter to support, you know, what we think is going to be growth in the S&P 500 companies. But you also have to remember that 44% of the earnings growth for the S&P 500 companies come from outside the United States. So you, then you have to take a look at the rest of the world, and the rest of the world isn't growing that fast. I mean, we are basically in a huge bubble.
All right. So we've had many, many guests on this program over the past year who have echoed a lot of what you said, Ed. But I always just like to give our guests the ability to, you know, give their own unvarnished opinion before I introduce any of that history or bias here. So sounds like you feel, you know, look at the market somewhat similarly to we do, where you look at the underlying economic growth. And yes, actually, GDP growth is likely to be, you know, pretty decent this quarter. But we got to remember we're coming off of a year where GDP was actually grew negatively for the year, given the pandemic. So we're looking at a high asset price, high asset prices. You use the term bubble. Let's now kind of go over into the cost of living. I think a lot of what we're going to talk about are trends that well preceded the coronavirus, but certainly the trillions of fiscal and monetary stimulus that are likely contributing to this asset price bubble you're talking about, I'm going to guess, based on your read of the data, has probably made consumer price inflation worse because that money begins to trickle into the real world and push the prices of real things up. So before we get into the details of that, though, let's do a little bit of context setting and history here for folks. Can you tell us why you constructed the Chapwood Index, and can you tell us sort of how it's calculated?
Well, so the Chapwood Index was a dream of mine, or it came about because my mother, when one day I had gone home and my mother had said something about my father not adjusting her alimony for cola. And I didn't know what cola was. I thought she drank Tab. That's all I knew was was that. So then she told me, she says, no, cost of living adjustment. And I thought, my goodness, I've never even heard of that. That's, it'll tell you the kind of training that I had early on. And then I went and started researching about the cost of living adjustment. And I came across a guy named Albert Singlinger in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania. And he started calculating the real cost of living increase starting in 1983 and showed how it was being manipulated by the government. And then eventually, at some point, Albert Singlinger passed away, and I found a guy named John Williams with shadowstatistics.com. And he was doing the real cost of living increase, but doing without all the manipulation that the government has played games with. And remember, the government wants you to have smaller transfer payments, that's Social Security payments and benefits of any kind. And so they do everything they can to make that number seem lower. So then what really got to me was, why aren't we doing this city by city? Because every single city has a different cost of living increase. So it's not the cost of living, it's the increase that kills people. Because you can get comfortable with your cost of living, but if your cost of living increase is 10% and you're only getting a raise of 4%, you know, only takes, you know, 4 years for you to be 24% behind. And that's what really got me to the point where I started calculating the real cost of living increase for the top 50 cities around the country.
All right. And so you talked about how the government statistics are very likely, you know, manipulated to look low because then the government doesn't need to pay as much on a going forward basis, right? Social Security payments grow at a slower rate if they use a slower cola, as you're mentioning. And the main metric that the government releases every month, that's sort of how it reports price inflation, is the CPI, Consumer Price Inflation Index. So that right now is, since the great financial crisis, it's largely been under 2% annual CPI. We saw, I think 1.4 in January, that was adjusted to 1.7 in February. So it's poking up a little bit. But how does that compare to the average rates in the Chapwood Index?
Well, the average rate in the Chapwood Index is about 10%, which sounds outrageous to people when they first hear that because they're comparing it to the government CPI. But if you start to really think about what, you know, that your food is not included in the CPI, insurance is not included in the CPI, taxes are not included in the CPI, and you start really looking at how they evaluate what the CPI is, it doesn't take you a long time to get to the point where you realize that it is about 10%. In California, you're looking at, in Oakland, you're looking at about 12%. Long Beach, you're looking at 11%. Los Angeles, you're looking at 12%. And Chicago, you're looking at about 11%. New York, you're looking at 11%. So, you know, and by the way, those are blue states because a lot of taxes are increased there, and those taxes are trickled down to the end consumer. So eventually it you know, the cost for you to go and get, I mean, I kind of kid around a little bit, but with a bagel, if you got a bagel every single day, every morning, the cost of a bagel goes up about 15 to 18 cents every single year. Well, that's $53 more a year that you're paying in just a bagel. I mean, it's when you start to really look at all the different cost of living increases that are not calculated in the CPI.
Great. All right. So here's where I really want to roll up my sleeves and get into it. And by the way, I live in one of those blue states. I'm in Northern California, you know, about an hour and a half from Oakland. So I can attest that 11%, 12% range feels a lot more realistic than versus what the government's published CPI is, at least for where I'm living.
Let me add one thing that what really kills me about this is the negative unintended consequences of this. And I'll explain why. People who are middle income and lower income people who go to work and get raises, their raises are based on the CPI. So you have people who are working their tails off, paying taxes, doing everything right, but they're getting increases that are keeping them from actually making any money. In fact, they're losing purchasing power every single year. So somebody who works in a factory, and they don't have to be middle income to work in a factory, but let's just say they're middle income people or lower income, they're going to get a raise that might be 1.5 to 2% when their cost of living increase is 10%. So every single year they're getting further behind. So no wonder there's problems and there's crime and there's, you know, broken families. This to me is one of the great tragedies that have happened in our country. The miscalculation and the misunderstanding of the consumer price index. And it's not just from the government's, you know, entitlement programs and their benefit programs, but it's in the private sector, raises are tied to this bogus statistic. And this is what's killing a lot of families.
All right. So I was trying to build up to this, but you went straight to it. So thank you for doing that. Because I share your outrage here. And if you look at, you're exactly right. You know, if you look at the cost of living is calculated by the Chapwood Index, you know, wages by no way keep up in terms of the same growth rate. So, and that's nominal wages, right? So real wage growth, and we've seen lots of charts of this, has been, you know, pretty meager, if not even just flat, you know, for decades now, while the real cost of living has, you know, far outpaced real wage growth. So you're right. It's just squeezing and squeezing and squeezing working families. It's a total tragedy, in my opinion. And just like the government, you know, it's in the interests, the bottom line interests of corporations to not have to raise your wages as or to raise your wages as little as possible for them going forward. Right. It's not fair, but you can understand the misincentive they have to use that. So, all right. So, you know, if that is reality, and I think, you know, anybody watching this who lives in the real world, Ed, right, you know, who buys food, who, you know, uses medical care, who drives a car, who has to afford a roof over their head, who has to educate their kids, they know that the real cost of living is not increasing less than 2% annually. They know it's much more than that. So I think they probably have a real gut resonance with just this topic. That, like, yeah, exactly, Ed, you're totally right. So here's a couple of questions. I guess the first one is, I get why the government is doing this, but why is the media not adopting indices like yours when it's reporting cost? Why is it sort of still universally embracing these bogus numbers? You know, you listen to any news, any business news show, you know, any nightly news when the new numbers come out, and they just report it totally unquestioned. How come at a minimum they're not using another index like yours to try to say, hey, you know what, maybe this index matches reality more.
Yeah, because most of the people in the media, and I've had a history with the media, most of the people there just repeat whatever is in a headline because they're very busy and they just want to repeat it and get it over with and move on. And it's a wonky subject. It's kind of difficult to explain to most people. So they just repeat it over and over again. And, you know, just like on your phone, you know, there'll be a news story out and you'll have five different pop-ups with the same story, the same exact story, because they just took it from the press release. So nobody wants to challenge the government and how they're calculating it, just like they do with the GDP numbers, the unemployment numbers, and the CPI numbers, as we're talking about. They just accept it on blind faith that the government is telling the truth. And, you know, but they should. They should absolutely challenge this. And they should look at the reason why these numbers are so wrong. They're not just a little bit wrong. It's not just a rounding error. They're tremendously incorrect. And the damage, as we said a second ago, you know, is insurmountable for most families.
Yeah. And I look, I get it. You know, the media is owned by, like, you know, all the, you know, most of the media is owned by like three or four corporations, right? There's this huge concentration in the media. We've talked about this in the past with experts like Matt Taibbi. And so maybe there's, you know, incentive for these corporate interests to parrot what the government's reporting. But, you know, most of the people, you know, who are behind the chairs and newsrooms, they're real people. You know, they have to pay bills and stuff like that. To me, it's akin to the weatherman saying, hey, everybody, today's going to be sunny and 70, but everybody can look out the window and see that it's 23 degrees and snowing. Right. It's that much of a disparity. So I don't know. I didn't necessarily expect you to have the answer there. But to me, it just it feels we're at that point of that vast a disparity from reality that it really just seems incredibly disingenuous. I'm not even going to say naive. I think you're maybe giving them the benefits of the doubt. I think it's very disingenuous. But let me ask the next big question, which is, how are folks surviving? Right. I mean, you can only handle so many years of double digit increase in your cost of living before you just don't have the income to make it. Right. We just talked about our incomes aren't growing nearly as fast. Right. You can only, and I mean, things just like healthcare alone. You know, if you're funding your own healthcare, you've been getting double digit increases now pretty much ever since the Affordable Health Care Act was passed. So, Ed, how are people dealing with this?
First thing is understanding what the problem is. And once they understand it, then, you know, what do? They start to cut back and they become, you know, they become less of a consumer. They buy less. They, you know, they certainly are not making as much because of the net result of the cost of living increase. So if they're making, you know, 5% on their portfolios and their cost of living is going up 8%, you know, they just lost 3% purchasing power. And this eventually wears on them. So a lot of people cannot afford to retire. I mean, I've seen statistics all the time about how many people, what percentage of the people out there can afford to have a $5,000 unexpected bill. And it's like 70% of the people can't afford that. And so you know, what I encourage people to do is get another job. I mean, they have to have an honest conversation about what is really happening with them. Now, it's different with the one percenters, because people who are the one percenters, and I'm going quote one percenters, these people earn money based on their productivity, but based on their abilities, because they're not getting a salary. They're out there making money and they're taking great risks. And those people can affect what they're making. So they can make more than 10% increase a year, or they can make 20% increase or outsized numbers. And they can also lose money. But that's the difference. And that's why you have such a disparity between those who have and those who don't have.
Yeah. And I'm gonna describe that differently. So those one percenters, so you mentioned people's portfolios, right? The reality is that, you know, I think half or more than half of America didn't even own any stocks, right? They don't have a portfolio. And then of the financial assets that are out there, stocks, bonds, et cetera, it's something like 80% of them are owned by the top 10%. So those top percenters you're talking about, they own the vast majority of the financial assets. And we started this conversation talking about the financial asset price bubble that we've had here, right? And all the stimulus that's been going out, both monetary and fiscal. And really what that's doing is that is greatly advantageous to those folks who hold those financial assets, which are those top percenters, right? And everybody else, they don't have that tailwind at their back, right? So all they have is their income, right? So so sadly, what you're saying is, you know, hey, those people are in many ways, they're kind of just out of luck. And, you know, we went from a society where you could have a one paycheck earner and, you know, raise a middle-class family off of that. Now you have to have two paycheck earners, and it's increasingly tough to stay in the middle class along with that. So now you're basically saying you need two paycheck earners with multiple jobs to just try to stay afloat. And this is definitely a story of regression. And honestly, it feels so unfair to me. I was almost going to pick the word evil, but it just seems so unfair because right now the game board favors those top percenters so much and the big corporations, et cetera, at the expense of virtually everybody else who's just trying to get by.
It really is exactly what you just said. You said it much better than I did, by the way.
No worries. Well, let me get to my other question on this. And I've tossed this out to a few other guest experts we've had on this program in the past, but I think you're a particularly good one to pontificate on this, which is, why is there not an army of people storming Washington over this, right? Like I said earlier, it's the difference between 70 and sunny versus below freezing and snowing. Like, people can see it. It's not a complicated argument at this point. And particularly, as you mentioned, seniors, right? I mean, the Fed and its policies, right, bringing interest rates down as low as it has for as long as it has, it has killed, you know, both ends of the generational spectrum. Right. It's helped contribute to the rise in asset prices. And so it's super hard for younger generations to build a foundation. Right. Because housing is out of reach for them in many ways. It's hard for them to, you know, create savings that they get a return on and can build a portfolio, because there's just, you know, there's virtually nothing that return that you're getting on your savings. And similarly, on the other end of the spectrum, people used to retire, and then you would retire on the income off of your portfolio. You'd usually live off of a fixed income, right? You'd get into bonds and safer investments, which now yield low single digits on a good day, right? So, you know, we've got 10,000 baby boomers hitting retirement age every day still. But these people, as you said earlier, they just can't afford to retire. One, because they're not getting any yield, but two, their cost of living is continuing to rise, right? So whatever is left over is just becoming less and less and less every year. So my question for you is, you know, how come the torches and pitchforks aren't out? And like, why isn't the AARP, you know, making this, why aren't they jumping on the end the Fed bandwagon and you know, arranging the Million Seniors March in Washington?
Well, they should be. But the reason is that it benefits both Democrats and Republicans to keep the inflation number low. And so, you know, a lot of people don't understand what's happening. They haven't taken the time to look at what happened in 1983 under Newt Gingrich, where he started to manipulate the CPI. And then again, the Boskin Commission, someone from Stanford in 1994, was asked to take a look at the cost of living increase or the CPI, and they reconfigured the CPI at that point. You know, there used to be 1,700 items that were calculated every single month. And they just took the raw data and used that. But the number got to 13.5% in 1981. So the government said, hey, we can't do this anymore. Let's change the way we calculate all of this. But if the number is low, it benefits Democrats, it benefits Republicans. But people need to understand it. That's why everyone should watch this conversation and understand that they should be out there with pitchforks and they should be having a march on Washington because of this. But it also isn't something that's in Washington's hands. You know, they can increase how much money people get with transfer payments, but they can't control the world economy. And the world economy is completely out of control in terms of costs going higher. That just the way they calculate it has changed. That's the biggest issue, is that the costs have continued to soar, but the way they calculate the increases has changed, as we've demonstrated here.
All right. So here's my additional concern, right? So you've talked about why the government calculates inflation the way that they do, and why it's in their interests and both sides of the aisle's interest to try to fool people that it's as low as it is. And of course, you know, your index is revealing what that true cost of living is. Here's my additional concern. we have two factors that I think are going to pour kerosene on this fire already. One is we have all this stimulus going out there into the world, right? And we are beginning to see that making its way into commodity prices, right? And when commodity prices have been somewhat depressed for the past 10 years, but we're now seeing them pick up, and we've had a number of guests on this program argue for why commodity prices are likely going to have a pretty nice tailwind for the foreseeable future. And one big reason is because part of the stimulus that's going on is infrastructure spending, right? And you need actual real things in the world to build infrastructure, and that's happening worldwide now. So when commodity prices goes up, those are the base inputs for everything else, right? So you're going to see an increase in prices just because of that demand. We are also seeing in a lot of key commodities, we're seeing notable depletion, right? Where they're becoming harder to find, harder to extract. And so that scarcity also drives prices up. So it's kind of like a 1-2 punch to base input prices. So we've got all of the political machinations that you talked about going on, and we have these kind of real world constraints. So I don't see a lot of like relief on the real cost of living anytime soon. Do you share this concern?
Well, without question. I mean, it's a concern. I didn't know about how tough it was to extract the commodities. That's something I was not aware of. But having said that, the infrastructure spending on top of the COVID stimulus, I mean, we're looking at another $2 trillion that they're talking about to do infrastructure repairs. And where is this money going to come from? It's all going to be a drain on the dollar. And as the dollar sinks, it's going to make more, things more expensive to buy from outside the United States. So if the dollar drops, I think we import about 60% of what we use in this country. I think that's the number I heard most recently. So we're bringing in things from outside the United States. So if the dollar drops, it's going to cost us that much more to go out and acquire these things. I mean, there's nothing good about this discussion.
There's not. And there is a class of people out there, and I'm going to show some of my personal bias here, but who, they're in favor of programs like universal basic income. And what I think a lot of these people don't fully appreciate is this concept of sort of velocity of money. But when you give money directly to people, it gets spent usually, right? So it finds its way into the economy. And a lot of the QE, the quantitative easing that the banks have been doing over the past bunch of years, hasn't been quote unquote inflationary, because a lot of that has sort of stayed on the balance sheets of a lot of big institutions. But when those dollars begin to get out in the real world, the velocity of money picks up, and that drives prices higher, right? So, people might say, look, I'm having trouble making my rent. If you, the government, give me an extra $1,000 a month, I can use that to pay my rent. And yes, you can. The problem is that rents in your area will quickly adjust for that extra money sloshing around. And all of a sudden, your rent's going to be a lot higher. And even though you're getting $1,000 from the government more every month, it's immediately getting eaten up by that price increase. So net net, you're really not any better, right? So there's just not a lot of relief, that you and I are seeing on the horizon that suggests that cost of living is going to moderate at any point soon. So, Ed, look, as we wrap up here, and thanks so much for giving so much of your time here. What policy changes would you like to see? If we should be doing things differently here at a high level, what are some changes you'd like to see enforced?
Well, I'm very much a free market person. I'd like to see lower taxes versus higher taxes. And I'd like to see more money in the pockets of people so they can go out and spend it in a free market environment. And I'd like to see very, much more reduced legislation. The regulations out there are only starting to build again. So I'm very much a free market person. And those are the things that I'd like to see. I can't imagine that the government is going to very quickly or at any point start raising how much money they give out in entitlement programs and transfer payments. I just can't imagine that. If anything, it's going to go lower. They're going to continue to try to make that argument that it's going to go lower, and that's not going to benefit anybody.
Okay. And then on the individual level, so we've got a lot of people watching this video, whether they were familiar with your index or not. I think, you know, they would most probably agree cost of living is higher than they would like it to be. And they're probably worried about where it's headed in the future. What advice would you have for those concerned investors who don't want to see their hard-earned nest eggs eroded away by the masked high rate of price inflation?
Yeah. Well, do you have an honest conversation with your financial advisor about what your real cost of living increase is and figure out what your real return is based on your holdings? So if you have a historical rate of return of 8 and you use a standard, whatever your standard deviation is, if you have a real rate of return of 8 and your cost of living increase is 8, be honest with yourself, you're not making any money. And that's what you have to know. And you have to then take different risks in your portfolio by using alternative investments and using high yield bonds and taking a little bit more risk than having your money in fixed income where, as you said earlier, your government numbers, government bonds are yielding you about 1 to 1.5%. You can't do that. So you have to become better educated on how to manage money and how to manage risk in a portfolio. And that's how you're going to save your nest egg.
Well, that's a great point, and it's a great segue because after we say goodbye to you here, Ed, we're going to talk with Mike Preston, lead partner from New Harbor Financial, who's the financial advisory firm that comes on this program with me every week to talk about what the markets have done. So I want to put some words in your mouth, and you tell me if you agree with them or not. But given your point there about risk, getting way back to your first answer about the asset price bubble we're in, the conundrum that so many of our viewers have is they are concerned about everything that you just mentioned, but they're very concerned about going out on the risk curve right now in the, these high price stocks and high yield bonds and all that type of stuff, because they fear that there is a, there's a price correction, probably a pretty sizable one that could happen given that we're at all time extreme levels of valuation, as you said earlier, right? So they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, right? They feel the pressure to reach for yield, but their brain is telling them, look, we might be in the last inning of this bubble here, at least in the near term. And I don't want to potentially risk losing half of my investment capital because I happen to be the greatest fool that put his chips on the table right before the big correction happened. So our big advice has always been, work with your professional financial advisor, provided, of course, they understand all the issues and the risks that we've been talking about here, but really try to work with one who prioritizes risk mitigation because if you go long in this market, given the fact that it's so at such high level evaluations, you want to have hedges in place to protect you in case indeed we do have a material correction. Would you agree with that?
Without question. And not just having hedges, because that's limiting, your downside, obviously, but it's also limiting your upside depending on how you put the hedge on. But look at managed futures. Look at other types of asset classes that you're not that familiar with and learn about them, because that's how you're going to make money in a sideways to down market.
But great, great point. All right, here. So as we wrap this up, Ed, and again, thank you for sharing so much of your time. I really hope that the world continues to look at alternatives to those published CPI numbers, alternatives like your index out there. And, God, please, if you're in the media and watching this, please just don't parrot, the CPI blindly. Look at Ed's indices, look at Shadow Stats, John Williams, like he mentioned, and at least give your viewers, a comparison between the two. But Ed, where can people go to find out more about you and your work?
I think go to chapwoodinvestments.com. And we have we built some proprietary calculators in our investment forensics division. It's a section on our website where we give real honest analytical insight into portfolios. And we created 8 metrics on how to properly evaluate a portfolio, and something that we're really proud of.
All right, excellent. And when we edit this video, I'll put up the URL there so folks can go to it and check it out. Ed, really appreciate you sharing so much of your time with us. Look forward to having you on the program again.
Thank you very much.